Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Planned Parenthood is making national headlines for the undercover attack videos of a conversation between an anti-abortion group called the Center for Medical Progress and Dr. Mary Gatter, the medical director at Planned Parenthood Pasadena and San Gabriel Valley. Dr. Gatter's comments about how Planned Parenthood clinics are reimbursed for facilitating the donations of fetal tissue have been edited to give the false impression that Planned Parenthood makes money by selling body parts. Today, at 2:30 Pacific time, Senate Republicans are voting on legislation to cut $500 million in annual federal funding for Planned Parenthood. Today's guest, David Cohen, says what's been lost in the intense focus on the brutally dishonest attacks on Planned Parenthood practices is that just as much as these videos are part of a highly orchestrated campaign to discredit Planned Parenthood and undermine legal and safe abortion, they're also part of an ongoing campaign to target and harass abortion providers and those connected with the safe and legal provision of abortion care. In their new book, Living in the Crosshairs, The Untold Stories of Anti-Abortion Terrorism, David Cohen and Kristen Conan chronicle the daily experiences of abortion providers and the dangers associated with offering basic medical care. The abortion providers they interview describe being harassed by protesters at work, in front of their homes, and in public spaces. Many wear bulletproof vests, carry guns, take different routes to work, hire body decoys, and find posters of their faces inside a bullseye. So what will it take to stop violence against abortion providers, their employees, and their families? And what legal and societal reforms would improve the lives of abortion providers? Why is targeted harassment defined as protest rather than terrorism? And what would that change? David Cohen is associate professor at the Drexel University Thomas R. Klein School of Law. He and Kristen Conan co-authored Living in the Crosshairs. David is a board member of the Women's Law Project in the Abortion Care Network, and he joins us on the line from Philadelphia. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me on today.
Well, it's great to have you. You interviewed 87 abortion providers, and their stories are just harrowing. I often was asking myself, how could this be happening in the United States? I mean, people are wearing bulletproof vests. They're buying guns. In one case, one doctor has a relationship with an airline. So if he has a ticket to fly on Tuesday, that's the ticket, he could actually fly the day before or after because he fears for his life. Do you think that this is widely known by the public?
No, and that's really the impetus for the book, because as much as major acts of violence get covered, for instance, there have been 8 abortion providers who've been murdered since 1993, and those murders get covered, and they are part of some of the general knowledge about abortion and the conflict in this country. And maybe every now and then you hear news about a clinic that's burnt down or something like that. But the day-to-day lives of abortion providers, what they go through, the harassment, the intimidation, the targeting, the terrorism that they face that's short of those extreme acts, that is not a part of the national consciousness. And that's really why we wrote this book, because there are people out there who work at abortion clinics, doctors, nurses, administrators, who do wear bulletproof vests to work, who do have a gun because of their security concerns. And that's just not what people think of medical practice in this country. And that's why we wrote this book.
And in many cases, the people you interviewed have never shared their stories before.
Right, absolutely. This is not something that people talk widely about for a bunch of reasons. For some people, it's just a matter of putting really bad moments of their life behind them and not wanting to dwell on them. For other people, it's a matter of safety, where they don't want to be too vocal about this for fear of inspiring worse. But the people that we ultimately were able to talk to, and of the 87 people we talked with, they work in 35 different states in this country. So we covered every region of the country and all different types of clinics and all different types of settings. The people felt that they want their stories to be out there now, because without people knowing about this, nothing's going to change.
And because the people who participated in these interviews really are risking their lives by revealing this information, you and they decided not to reveal their real names. And almost all of the names in the book are fictional. Almost all of the descriptions of the providers are generalized and nonspecific. So we know what part of the country they work in, but we don't know exactly where.
Right. We couldn't be more specific than that because people were concerned that if their information, their specific information got out, it could mean that someone might target them even more. And in some ways, it's very sad that people can't be more public about this and can't come out stronger about this, but they fear for their own safety, they fear for their families, their children, their parents, their coworkers. And so almost everyone in the book uses some kind of fake name and a region of the country to describe where they work because they can't be more specific.
And we'll talk about specific stories that they shared. But I want to talk about what's happening in the national news right now. At 2:30 this afternoon, Republicans are going to vote to defund Planned Parenthood. They want to cut $500 million in annual federal funding for Planned Parenthood. And you have written about these attacks for RH Reality Check, and you argue that, I mean, this is related to the videos that have been released, the undercover attack videos that were released by the anti-abortion group called the Center for Medical Progress. And you say that what's been lost in the focus on these dishonest attacks on Planned Parenthood's practices is that just as much as these videos are part of a campaign to discredit Planned Parenthood and undermine abortion, they're also part of a campaign to target and harass abortion providers. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Everyone's talking about how this is an attack on Planned Parenthood, and this risks Planned Parenthood's $500 million. It serves millions and millions of women and other people as well per year. And that this could jeopardize that for Planned Parenthood, or these videos could jeopardize that money and that funding. And that's a very serious problem and very legitimate concern, and I'm very hopeful and optimistic, actually, that this afternoon's vote is going to fail because it won't get enough votes to pass the filibuster. But nonetheless, it's a very serious attack on Planned Parenthood. But we cannot lose sight of the fact that Planned Parenthood was not in those videos. There was not just a Planned Parenthood being interviewed or being talked to at a restaurant. There were individual doctors and individual clinic employees who were in the videos, and they were identified, and they are the ones who are being vilified as individuals. They are the ones who are suffering in the wake of these videos, because since those videos have been published, there's been all sorts of hate mail, online harassment, even death threats levied against these abortion providers because of what's in the video. For instance, one of them, the doctor who was in the very first video, a doctor from Southern California, there was a post online that said, "I'll pay 10 large to whoever kills Dr. Deborah Nucatola. Anyone, go for it." That is an explicit death threat that she has suffered because of these videos. So we cannot deny that this is an attack on Planned Parenthood, but at the same time, we have to maintain our focus on the fact that individuals are suffering as a result of these videos and are getting harassed and death threats because of them.
And the National Abortion Federation has filed for an injunction against this group, the Center for Medical Progress, the group that has the video.
Right. So the National Abortion Federation filed a lawsuit in San Francisco on Friday of last week. And late on Friday, a judge issued what's called a temporary restraining order, which means a very short-lived order saying that the Center for Medical Progress cannot publish any new videos that have information about NAF, the National Abortion Federation's annual meeting, which is highly confidential and secret, or information they learned from those meetings, or videos that they may have recorded at those meetings. So those are now prohibited from being released. There's going to be a hearing at 4:00 this afternoon in federal court in San Francisco to determine whether that order should continue, and I hope that it does. I hope the judge continues to find there's reason to block the future release of videos with this information. But it's important to understand that this order, this court order, is limited only to videos that are related to the NAF annual meeting. So this order would not prevent the release of videos that are not about the NAF annual meeting or not filmed there. So it doesn't prevent the Center for Medical Progress from releasing any videos, just that small subset of videos. Nonetheless, it's an important step to block them from doing something that is an invasion of privacy, encourages harassment, is fraudulent. It also goes against the confidentiality agreements they sign in order to attend those conferences. And I could go on with other legal claims, too. But there's a lot that's illegal behind these videos.
What do we need to know about these videos? Because they have set off a wave of protests across the country. The Washington Post reports that activists gathered in 64 cities on July 28th to rally against Planned Parenthood, drawing about 12,000 people. And then again, of course, the Republicans are talking about this in most of their interviews and are planning to vote to defund Planned Parenthood. So what is your take on these videos?
Well, the most important thing that I think we need to know about these videos is that they are highly dishonest and make claims that are just completely untrue. And in fact, the full videos, unedited versions of the videos, which the center also subsequently has released, prove that the basic claims made about the videos are just lies. So the two main claims about the videos are that one, that Planned Parenthood sells fetal parts after abortions, and two, that it alters abortion procedures in order to make sure that it can have a more profitable sale of fetal parts. Neither of those are true, and in fact, the videos show again and again, the fully unedited versions of the videos show again and again, all of the doctors saying that they do not sell fetal parts. They are reimbursed for costs associated with the procedure and with transportation, and that is completely legal under federal law. So federal law allows those reimbursements. That's why we're talking $30, $50. We're not talking a large sum of money. That is completely lawful, and they say that over and over again in the video that they are not selling, but those parts were removed. And then second, they say again and again that they don't change the abortion procedure in order to have a better piece of tissue in order to donate for fetal tissue research. And they say that again and again in the unedited transcripts and in the unedited videos, but those are removed. So the videos are highly edited to make it look like Planned Parenthood does something that it doesn't do. Unfortunately, the false claim is what's getting the political traction, and that's what's bringing about this vote this afternoon.
What are your thoughts on the media covering this and letting the public know that this was highly edited? Because now you've got Senator Rand Paul using this to raise money. Jeb Bush has called for a congressional investigation. Governor Bobby Jindal of Louisiana launched a statewide investigation. Governor Scott Walker of Wisconsin boasted that one of his first acts in power was to cut Planned Parenthood state funding. So this is just really taking off. A lot of people probably still don't know that the video was not edited.
Yeah, I mean, the
or what, right, was edited.
It was,
yes,
edited. Was highly edited, yes. To be deceptive, intentionally deceptive. I mean, it really, the videos fit into a longstanding narrative that the Republicans have to demonize Planned Parenthood, knowing full well that a lot of their constituents, Republicans and Democrats alike, benefit from the services that Planned Parenthood provides. And that abortion rates go down because of the services that Planned Parenthood provides. The money that the federal government gives to Planned Parenthood does not go towards abortion. It goes towards contraception and breast cancer screening and other medical services, some of which do a great job at reducing the abortion rate. So the Republicans are targeting a group that works very hard to reduce abortions in this country. And any cutoff of money will increase the abortion rate in this country. And it's also something that, you know, can't be lost in this discussion either, which is that fetal tissue research, something which apparently a lot of people are very uncomfortable talking about, but fetal tissue research really does benefit people with life-saving medical treatments and cures for diseases, and it's something that research universities and research labs have been doing for a long time. And some Planned Parenthood affiliates, far from all of them, facilitate that research, not by selling baby parts, but by donating fetal tissue with the consent of the women who have terminations.
How do you think that Planned Parenthood and the media should deal with this? I mean, this is going to be a major talking point at the Republican debate this Thursday. And I'll be curious to find out if the moderator says that this video was highly edited.
Yeah, I mean, everyone who talks about this video should be very careful to say that these are highly edited. These are claims that are defamatory and could be, you know, there could be liability there. It could be liable for media outlets that repeat defamatory claims. So people have to be careful about this. But, you know, There's the political issue that Planned Parenthood's trying to beat back. There are investigations in the states and in the federal government that Planned Parenthood's trying to beat back. It would be nice if there were also legal action to try and block these videos. We've seen limited legal action from NAF and from a company called Stem Express, which is a biotech company that has successfully so far sued to block release of videos that it was in. I'd like to see the same to block the videos that Planned Parenthood members are in, because they are in this, they've been videotaped without consent, which is illegal in California, and very likely there were confidentiality agreements that have been violated as well. I'd like to see YouTube take down the videos, because these videos violate YouTube's terms of service, in that YouTube says that it will not post videos that have identifying information that people did not consent to being released, which is exactly what these videos are. They're also harassing. So I think that there's still more to be done to try and fight these videos.
Today, I am speaking with David Cohen. He is out with a new book, Living in the Crosshairs, The Untold Stories of Anti-Abortion Terrorism. He wrote this book with Kristen Conan. They chronicle the daily experiences of abortion providers and the dangers they face. Many wear bulletproof vests. They carry guns. They take different routes to work. They hire body decoys. They find posters of their faces inside a bullseye. In some cases, they find posters of themselves, or a clinic worker, for example, will drive to work and find posters of the doctor all along her route to work. And this is happening every day in this country. If you have any questions about what abortion providers face, what are your thoughts on this? If you work for a clinic, we'd love to hear from you. If you're a doctor, what are your thoughts? 866-798-8255. And if you have any questions about the videos that have surfaced and the vote that's taking place today to defund Planned Parenthood, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So let's talk about these providers. Again, you interviewed 87 providers who deal with regular harassment. And the situation is actually getting worse, because according to recent research, the kind of targeted harassment that you document has actually increased since 2010. What explains that?
Well, I think there's a bunch of things that explain it. Probably the most important is that since 2010, we've seen a rise in the Tea Party movement within the Republican Party, a major part of their platform being to restrict and end legal abortion. And they've been very successful in a lot of states. We've seen a huge wave of anti-abortion legislation. And there's some research that shows that in states where there's an increase of anti-abortion legislation, we see an increase in anti-abortion harassment and intimidation and targeting, the stuff that's in our book. And so I think that that's part of it. There's this correlation between the anti-abortion legislation and this kind of harassment that we've seen. That's not to say that it only happens in states with restrictive abortion laws. One of the things that we found in our book is that this kind of anti-abortion harassment and terrorism does happen everywhere in the country. This is not something that people in San Francisco, or where I am here in Philadelphia, blue states and blue cities, can say, oh, that's something that's restricted to the most conservative parts in the country, I don't have to worry about it. This kind of harassment and targeting does happen all across the country, no matter the political leanings of the place. So it's something we need to all be concerned about.
When you interviewed these providers, were you shocked at first by what you heard? For example, Christina Romero is a regional director for clinics in a west-south central state. And she told you, quote, they call you by name. They know your kids' names. They know your mom and dad's names. They know where you go to church. She says she receives cards in the mail that describe what type of car she drives and where she drives. She's also been followed home. I mentioned the doctor that has a relationship with the airlines that allow him to fly a day before or after what it says on his ticket. Another doctor has a fast car so he can get away from people. Did this surprise you at first?
You know, yes, absolutely. I knew some of these stories. I was familiar with some of the history, and I knew some of these individuals and some of the things that they were dealing with, but I did not know the full extent of it. And I think almost everyone that I've talked with, people who've been in part of this movement for decades, who've read the book and have said, wow, I knew there were things like this going on. I didn't know it was this bad. I didn't know that kids were stalked or nursing homes where a provider's parent lives have been protested, or that so many doctors and so many nurses think about or even purchase bulletproof vests or guns. You know, I'm going to read a short quote from one of the doctors we interviewed, and I think this really gets across. He says, "If anyone told me when I was in medical school that I would go to work armed and with a bulletproof vest, I would have thought they were nuts. But I do have a bulletproof vest, and I do go to clinics armed these days." I mean, this surprises even the people who are in the field, because, you know, at heart, they are medical care providers, just like any other medical care provider, but because of the procedure that they are experts in, they are targeted in this way.
You also interviewed Rodney Smith, who has provided abortion care in many different regions of the country. And he talks about having the arrangement with the airlines. He also says he doesn't eat at the same restaurant on a regular basis. When he does go to a restaurant, he tries to be in and out within 30 minutes so that if someone sees him and calls before someone else can get there, he's not there. After Dr. George Tiller was murdered in 2009, U.S. Marshals were at Rodney's clinic to protect him. Rodney explained that they had a list of a small number of doctors around the country who they believed were a significant risk. And then he tells a story about something that happened in the early 1990s. Protesters targeted Rodney in a very direct and violent manner. One day he was working at the clinic when he received a call from a police officer who told him his house and his barn were on fire. The fire was so large that an Air Force plane flying over the scene saw the fire and reported it. But despite that call, it took three calls before the firefighters appeared, and he lost everything.
Yeah, I mean, Rodney suffered some of the most severe harassment and targeting that we found when we talked to people, and it's ongoing. After Dr. Tiller was murdered, like you talked about, not only did Rodney have a U.S. Marshal protection, but his daughter received a phone call telling her that her parents had been killed, which was not true, but you can imagine how terrifying that is for her in the wake of someone like Dr. Tiller being murdered. And Rodney was also attacked in the U.S. Supreme Court courtroom when he was involved in a Supreme Court case around abortion. So he suffered some of the worst that we saw. But like almost everyone else that we talked to in the book, and there was only one person who's different, Rodney withstands this harassment because he's so committed to abortion care and to the patients. And in fact, it was after his house and his farm were set ablaze that he said to himself, "I'm going to stop being a part-time abortion provider, and now I'm going to be a full-time abortion provider because they're not going to defeat me." And he says it's his patients, because of his patients, that he continues despite being a target.
We're talking today with David Cohen. He's author of the new book, Living in the Crosshairs, The Untold Stories of Anti-Abortion Terrorism. David and Kristen Conan chronicle the daily experiences of 87 abortion providers who tell harrowing stories about what it is like to go to a clinic every day to perform a safe and legal abortion. Many of these providers, people who work at the clinics, wear bulletproof vests, they carry guns, they take different routes to work, they hire body decoys, they find posters of their faces inside a bullseye, their kids' names are exposed, their parents' names are exposed. So what will it take to protect abortion providers? What will it take to stop this violence against providers, their employees, and their families? This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on local public radio, KALW, San Francisco. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question you feel needs to be answered, we invite you to join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Remember, it's a toll-free call. You can also send a toll-free email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock, World Have Your Say from the BBC. Following that at noon, it's Backstory. And then this afternoon at 1, Alternative Radio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation with reporter Christina Rizga about her new book, Mission High. She asks, what happens when teachers and students defy the government and come up with their own solutions for fixing failing schools? Based on test scores, San Francisco's Mission High is a, quote, low-performing school, even though its graduation attendance rates and college enrollment percentages are some of the best in the country. That's tomorrow. If you have a guest idea or a show idea, you can email us feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today I am speaking with David Cohen about his new book, Living in the Crosshairs, The Untold Stories of Anti-Abortion Terrorism. David and Kristen Conan interviewed 87 abortion providers about the daily dangers they face when they go to the clinic to perform a safe and legal abortion. David is a law professor at Drexel University Thomas R. Klein School of Law, where he teaches constitutional law and gender and the law. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. What questions do you have about violence against abortion providers? What will it take to protect providers if you work in a clinic? Or you have any personal stories to share, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And now I would like to welcome Merle Hoffman. She's an award-winning journalist, activist, and women's healthcare pioneer. In 1971, Merle founded Choices, one of the first ambulatory abortion centers, which has become one of the nation's largest women's medical facilities in the U.S. Merle is the publisher of On the Issues, an online feminist magazine, and author of the book Intimate Wars, The Life and Times of the Woman Who Brought Abortion from the Back Alley to the Boardroom. And Merle joins us from New York. Hi, Merle. Welcome back to the show.
Very good to be with you.
Well, it's so good to have you. So we've been talking with David about the highly edited videos against Planned Parenthood. We're talking about the vote to defund Planned Parenthood at 2:30 today, but also just these harrowing stories that providers have to deal with on a regular basis. You opened Choices back in 1971. Did you ever think that we'd be having this conversation about people wearing bulletproof vests and carrying guns to work in the year 2015?
It doesn't surprise me, because you have to remember that I've been in this struggle, in this war, for now 44 years. And I've seen it ebb and flow. In the beginning, I was the golden child that opened Choices and, you know, was talking about feminist analysis and types of provision of services and counseling and informed consent and women's right to control their own bodies. And slowly, I'd say by the late 70s, what began as, you know, really something wonderfully radical and pioneering became a lightning rod. So I started to see the anti-choice reaction to that in terms of marches, trying to get into my clinic, death threats, the murder of my friend George Tiller, two evictions where I was thrown out of space that I had been in 20 years, all along the way. So I am not surprised, because I didn't see what I thought should be a far more proactive and strategic pro-choice response to this continuing assault by the anti-choice forces. So, no, I'm not surprised.
What are your thoughts about what the public knows and doesn't know? Because we cover these issues on a regular basis, but it's kind of shocking. I mean, we were even shocked to read that this is so systemic and that children's names are exposed, people are followed on a regular basis.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Every Saturday, I have about 15 to 25 anti-choice radicals who are outside of Choices. This is in New York City now, not Nebraska or Iowa. And they're screaming at patients, you know, you are killing the legacy of Martin Luther King. You are killing your babies. Because I offer prenatal care, they tell the mothers with the children by their side, do you know that your mother's going in there to kill your brother or your sister? I've had the FBI involved. I mean, this is a continual struggle. And their response is that, well, this is free speech. We have a right to do that. Well, yes, you do, but you can't cry fire in a crowded theater, and you can't harass women going in for a constitutionally protected procedure.
And Merle, how do you deal with this? What was really interesting is David interviewed providers about the law and how they deal with it. In one case, one doctor has a good relationship with the police force in his home county. So the protests in front of his home have dwindled, but he doesn't have a good relationship with the police force where his clinic is. So, you know, they're not offering him the same protection.
I make a big fuss. I stand and make a big fuss. What I try and do is work with the local police, the local politicians. If that doesn't work, I always go up. So what resulted from the harassment at my facility was a big press conference at City Hall with Christine Quinn, who at that time was in charge. And she actually started to train escorts out of City Hall, and that was tremendously attacked too. Fortunately, New York is somewhat progressive, but it is shocking, even in New York, that we have this situation. They haven't gone away. Everybody is very careful to say they have the right of free speech, but patients come in invariably hysterical and upset because they don't want to be called a murderer.
David, what else did you hear from providers about how they deal with this in terms of, you know, working with police, the police force? One of the providers you interviewed, Lucy, says that she decided not to press charges. She doesn't press charges because she fears that if she does, the protesters would obtain her address and then knock on her door. David?
Yes.
Go
I'm
ahead.
Here.
You're there. Go ahead.
So, yeah, sorry. One of the complicating factors here is that when providers try to use the legal system to their advantage by pressing criminal charges or bringing a civil lawsuit, there's a lot of information about themselves that can come out as a result. And that means that their where they live might be a part of this, who their family members are, who they work with. We talked with one provider who was subject to a lawsuit. And they started asking her every name of someone who works at their clinic, where the security cameras are. So using the legal system can be very invasive in ways that just add to the harassment, and that's one of the challenges. But to pick up on the story that Merle was talking about, using city council and to try and get support, we talked with a bunch of providers who have similar attitudes trying to garner political support, including one clinic owner who said that any politician who comes to her seeking a donation, she says, I will give you a donation if you come to my clinic on a Saturday morning and you stand outside and you see what's happening in your town or your district and you experience that. And she said it's eye-opening because they may have read about it or they may just know generally about it, but for them to actually sit outside the clinic and see what patients and providers go through on a weekly or daily basis in some places, that can really change things. So the more politicians are aware of things like this, I think the better.
Well, and if you want to see this, you can go, if you live in San Francisco, you can go to the Planned Parenthood on Valencia. There are protesters in front of that clinic almost every day with huge, horrible photos and pretty loud music. That's probably pretty tame, Merle. This is actually fairly new. We haven't had consistent protesters in San Francisco, but they have been there for the past, I'd say, 2 years.
Listen, I have to say something. You know, I understand why people don't want to use the legal system for redress. You know, I mean, okay, so, but that is because the right has been so effective in shaming people to be able to stand up for this issue. You know, if you think about over 1 million abortions a year and all the families and friends involved with that, I mean, and then extrapolate that for the last 30-odd where abortion has been legal. I mean, this is more than half or probably three-quarters of this country. But everybody is closeted. They're all in the closet. You know, so they say, oh, my God, if I go the legal route and somebody finds out my name or where I work. But it should be the people where you work probably have been involved in abortion. One third of every woman, American woman, before she's 45 has a legal abortion. So really, it's as American as apple pie. But that's what I talk about the pro-choice movement. It's always on the defensive. Always, you know, stand up and say, yes, I had an abortion. And I personally had an abortion. Until we can do that, we will not be able to fight this.
Merle Hoffman is an award-winning journalist and women's health care pioneer. In 1971, she founded Choices, one of the first abortion centers. She's publisher of On the Issues and author of Intimate Wars, The Life and Times of the Woman Who Brought Abortion from the Back Alley to the Boardroom. David Cohen is associate professor at the Drexel University Thomas R. Klein School of Law. He and Kristen Conan wrote Living in the Crosshairs, The Untold Stories of Anti-Abortion Terrorism. They interviewed 87 abortion providers about the daily violence and the protests that they deal with. If you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Carlos in Oakland. Hi, Carlos. Welcome to the show.
Yes, hello. Good morning.
Good morning. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. I'm going to see if I can try to word this in the best way I can. I was a part of an abortion with my ex-wife about 30 years ago. When I saw the little parts of the baby or fetus or whatever being pulled apart and sucked away, it was horrible to Maximus. And I that day I decided I would never be for abortion ever again, because it's really horrible. It's not right. Now, when the person is sick, okay, that gives me an idea that it's a moral thing or a necessity. Other than that, it, just because the system is not set up to help people, girls who are pregnant early or whatever, in better ways than abortion, that's a different issue. But
so you're saying, can I just ask you, Carlos? I can't hear you very well. If you can turn your radio down, I think that might be the problem.
Okay.
So you're saying that based on your personal experience, you now oppose abortion?
Right. That's one thing. I come from the Communist Party. I come from the left. Couldn't be no more progressive, no more pro-choice and everything like that. But when I saw that, it changed my mind. You and I, in the right mind, you cannot say that a little thing that is being born after the second of the insemination and starts forming a body, right there is life. Anybody can see that. Anybody can understand that that's life.
All right. Well, Carlos, thank you for calling in. We've got full lines. Let's take a few more, and then we'll get comments from listeners. Let's go to KDF in Oakland. Hi, KDF. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Rose. I was wondering, since Loretta Lynch is now in charge of enforcing the laws in the United States, does she already have an anti-abortion terrorist task force, or what chances do your guests believe there are for setting up such a task force in the Department of Justice?
All right. Thank you for that. That was a pointed question. So do you know about that, David?
Sure. So it's an interesting story. Months after President Obama became president, the Department of Homeland Security issued a document that talked about domestic terrorism and the threat of domestic terrorism, and it included anti-abortion extremists within the definition of domestic terrorism. There was intense and immediate pushback from many different forces, including anti-abortion forces. And Janet Napolitano, who was the head of the Department of Homeland Security at the time, apologized and said that the document was released in draft form and it should have never been released. Now, what's really horrific about it is that 3 weeks later, Dr. Tiller was assassinated by a domestic terrorist. Mm. But the Obama administration has not come forward to try and reinstate that definition. But to be fair, the Department of Justice does have a task force within it that is responsible for violence against abortion providers, and there are several lawyers in the Department of Justice who work on claims around violence against abortion providers and enforcing the federal law called the FACE Act, which is called the Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances Act. And for the cases that they bring, they do a great job and they are committed to it. So that is part of the protection, but we need I believe, and the people that we interviewed for our book believe, we need stricter penalties under the law, and we need judges who are more willing to enforce it and not see this as a First Amendment issue.
And Lisa writes that she read last year in Ms. Magazine that Republicans pressured the FBI to move the investigation of domestic terrorism or, for example, anti-abortionists away to so-called Muslim terrorists, she says. So now there's little investigation of these abortion terrorists. Is that related to what you were just talking about?
Yeah, I mean, for ever since September 11th, the idea of terrorism in this country has taken on a specific religion and a specific type of person, to the almost completely ignoring the idea that we do have a long history of domestic terrorism around abortion and other right-wing extremism in this country. I mean, just look at Timothy McVeigh in Oklahoma City, killing over 100 people. That was domestic terrorism, but. And I believe there was a new report in the past year showing that domestic terrorism still kills a lot of people in this country. But to many people, including some in government, terrorism is strictly limited to relationship to Islam and that kind of terrorism.
And you talk about legal and societal reforms that could actually improve the lives of these providers, and you say that we need to begin by redefining targeted harassment as terrorism rather than protest. Why do you think that's so important?
Well, I think the definition of terrorism, one of the common definitions of terrorism is people using violence or the threat or fear of violence to try and accomplish a political goal that they have not been able to obtain through other normal political channels. And that's what's happening here, because as much as the right has been very successful in limiting abortion, there's a number of people who believe they have been very unsuccessful, and they have been, at eliminating abortion. And the abolitionists within the anti-abortion movement want nothing short of complete abolition of abortion. And they feel that they failed because we're 42 years post Roe v. Wade, and as much as abortion has been restricted, and it has not been completely eliminated. So they have failed through normal political channels to accomplish that. So they are using violence and the threat of violence, and they have been doing this for a while, to try and accomplish that goal. That is terrorism, plain and simple.
Right.
Merle, do you want to jump in there? What changes would
we
see?
I know that when I was threatened with death by these terrorists, fundamentalist terrorists, Janet Reno sent armed guards down to guard me for 3 months, day and night, at Choices. So I think that really it also depends on the leadership at the top and who, you know, Napolitano, Reno, whatever. But that was very, very responsive. She was right there and very supportive. The problem with naming it terrorism has a lot to do with the politics. They don't even want to name the terrorism by Muslim fundamentalists and radicals as Muslim terrorism. There's a lot of political correctness that's going on that disenables the reality from being addressed. I know that a lot of facilities have closed. I'm very aware that the ones that exist are struggling and do so with great courage and integrity. They're, instead of being viewed as pariahs in this society, they really should be seen as what they are, which is tremendously courageous outposts for women's health, mainly poor and minority women's health. Again, once again, I want to go to the fact that it's up to all of us to change the attitudes around abortion. It's up to all of us to claim the process of reproductive freedom as opposed to running away from it and being closeted. Now, just think what's going on with the police brutality issues and the black communities in this country. They rise up as one. They rise up as one if any one of their people is touched. There's no such support for women or for clinics at all. This is not just the responsibility of the courts, David. This is not just the responsibility of the president. This is the responsibility of each and every one of us who live in this society, or else the right will win.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I mean, one of the things when people ask, well, what can we do? One of the first things I always say, what you can do is you can go down to your local clinic and volunteer to be an escort. And the second thing you can do is vote and tell other people to vote, and vote knowing exactly what you said, which is that abortion is as American as apple pie. One
right.
in three women will have an abortion, and other people know and love people who have abortions.
That's
so
right.
you need to vote based on this, and you need to be out there helping clinics.
But yeah, I mean, because you're right. It is each and every one of us. And the lack of courage that I see, that I hear about, oh, I won't file a legal report. My name will be on, my God, that really infuriates me.
We have a few emails. Rose says, I want to personally thank Planned Parenthood for the fact that I never had to make the difficult decision to have an abortion. I came of age in the 60s and never had an unplanned pregnancy because Planned Parenthood was there for me with reliable birth control and family planning. It cannot be stressed enough that the best prevention for abortion is birth control, and Planned Parenthood does a lot to prevent abortion. Janelle says, I had an abortion years ago before it was legal. I went to Tijuana in desperation and subsequently almost died from infections. Thank you for this program. The claim pro-life should be changed to pro-birth. Those same defenders of curtailing women's rights cut welfare, cut aids of all sorts, and will not fund contraceptives. Yay to Planned Parenthood, she says. Well, thanks for the emails, Janelle and Rose. And you can email us feedback at yourcallradio.org or give us a call at 866-798-8255. David, when you interviewed the providers, what were their thoughts when you talked to them about laws and social movements?
I think that some providers were optimistic that things could get better and that there could be reform that comes from, for instance, a home picketing ordinance that prevents home picketing in a particular location or zones around clinics, which the Supreme Court has not been very favorable about, but some places still have protest-free zones around clinics and that those things help. That there are things that can be done. But at the same time, there is a lot of skepticism from some providers that the law is the solution, because we've seen over the past several years the law being used to shut down clinics and really restrict abortion. And in a lot of places in the country, there's just no hope of getting any kind of good affirmative laws. They're doing their best to fight back against the laws that are strangling their existence. Look at Texas, where we had over 40 clinics a couple years ago, and if the Supreme Court doesn't step in, we could have 7 clinics for the second most populous state in the country, which is horrific. I mean, who is that going to impact? That's going to impact the poorest, most rural women in this country. And so, a lot of providers are just fighting for their lives against very restrictive laws. And so I think Merle's absolutely right. We have to win over people's hearts and minds by talking about it and by being out there and having people see what's going on in front of clinics, in people's lives. But that's a tough thing for some people to do because of this violence.
But if we all do it together.
Right. No, I agree. If we all do it together and
right.
if we fight against the stigma.
Like the gay rights movement, one comes out of the closet, another one comes out. And then there's a wave that you can't stop. And then you're reading about marriages in the New York Times. I mean, that's an and I think it's important for the pro-choice movement to look at the gains of the gay rights movement strategically in the sense of how that happened and why that happened.
And Merle, what about bringing more of these stories out into the public? I mean, David, when you share these stories with people, do you find that their perception about the issue changes? Or, what reaction do you get?
So people are surprised, even people within the movement, people who are on the front lines might not know that this is happening to other people they may even work with. And I think that goes to the point that Merle's getting at. Not enough people talk about this and talk about their experiences. And that really underlies this book, which is the more people talk about their experiences, hopefully we can change people's mind that this should be off the table. I want to go back to the caller Carlos's position that he says he's against abortion now. Well, that's fine for himself, for his own position about his own life. Mm-hmm. And I know that Merle and I are not going to convince everyone on the idea of abortion. But we should all agree that people who go to work in a lawful profession and their families and their kids and their neighbors should not be harassed, they should not be tormented, they should not be terrorized. And the women who go and seek a lawful medical procedure should not be terrorized either. I think we hopefully can find common ground on that.
And Merle, final thoughts?
My final thoughts is that we must face this issue for what it is, that abortion is terminating potential life. It is a difficult decision. It is a necessary decision. It is a decision that only a woman who carries that pregnancy can make within the context of her family and her life. And I think that part of the problem with this is that there is still a lack of respect for women as active moral agents and an institutional misogyny. So, again, look in the mirror when you ask, why is this happening? Everyone out there who is progressive and conscious, look in the mirror and answer it.
And Merle, when you look at the statistics, 89% of U.S. counties have no abortion provider.
I know.
I mean, that's...
I know. And you know why? I did a whole study called Abortionomics and looked at the fact that not only are they cutting off abortion, they're cutting off birth control.
Right.
So now you're in a Kafkaian reality where, well, you don't want to be pregnant, but, hey, you can't go 600 miles to get birth control. So then you get pregnant when you don't want to be. You can't afford to get to a clinic, or there is no clinic. Then you're in your second trimester. So there are two options here. You either have a child you don't want and cannot support, or you try to get an illegal abortion. And that's where we are today.
According to the Guttmacher Institute, Title X family planning centers prevent 1 million unintended pregnancies a year. 345,000 would have ended in abortion. It also averts 53,000 cases of chlamydia, 8,800 cases of gonorrhea, saves the lives of 1,100 women who would otherwise die of cervical cancer.
But they want Planned Parenthood closed because they don't care about cervical cancer. They don't care about STIs. They don't care about women, basically.
Merle Hoffman is an award-winning journalist and women's health care pioneer. In 1971, she founded Choices, one of the first abortion centers. She is author of Intimate Wars, The Life and Times of the Woman Who Brought Abortion from the Back Alley to the Boardroom. And David Cohen is co-author with Kristen Conan of the book Living in the Crosshairs, The Untold Stories of Anti-Abortion Terrorism. David and Merle, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. What happens when teachers and students defy the government and come up with their own solutions for fixing failing schools? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with reporter Christina Rizga about her new book, Mission High. Based on test scores, San Francisco's Mission High is a low-performing school, even though its graduation, attendance rates, and college enrollment percentages are some of the best in the country. What does this reveal about education reform? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Ruz is on as senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
This is Local Public Radio, KALW, San Francisco. You can contribute to the quality of life in the Bay Area by upgrading your vehicle to something that's more fuel efficient. And when you do, why not donate the old car to KALW? You get a tax deduction, and we benefit from the proceeds of the resale of the car. More details on our website, kalw.org, or you can call 888-525-9227. Up next, World Have Your Say from the BBC. The program was recorded earlier this morning for broadcast at this time. It's 11 o'clock, and this is Local Public Radio, KALW San Francisco.
Hello, I'm Chloe Tilley. Welcome to World Have Your Say. We begin with fresh allegations of doping in athletics.
There was something like 146 medals at Olympics and World Championships which were won by suspicious athletes. And none of those medals have been stripped away from anyone. They're all still standing.
An investigation claims the blood test results of hundreds of athletes show the extraordinary extent of cheating by them at the world's biggest events. The head of World Athletics has defended the testing programme, saying it's laughable to suggest they don't test rigorously. We'll hear from athletes, journalists and a man who defends the right to use drugs in sport. Plus, is Nigeria winning the battle against Boko Haram? And after a teenage girl is stabbed to death at Gay Pride in Jerusalem, we'll look at the role these marches play around the world.